number 7366, reel number 1.
Colonel Wilde, reel 1. Colonel, you joined the artillery in January 1935 as a second lieutenant. Could you tell me why you had decided to join the army and why it was the artillery that attracted you?
Yes, certainly. I came from a naval family, actually. And from the time when one was a tiny boy, when one became 12, one went to Dartmouth. I'd never heard of any other possible career. So I duly sat for Dartmouth, and all went all right until the medical examination came along, and they said, "What colour is this piece of wool?" And I got everything wrong. They all clustered round me and said, "You're colourblind, you failed the Navy." And so I went back to a slightly shaken naval family and said, "I failed the Navy, what do I do?" Because really I'd never heard of anything else, surprising as it may be. And my mother turned up trumps and said, "Well, why don't you follow your Uncle Jack into the gunners?" And I said, "What are gunners?" And she said, "I'm not absolutely certain, but I think they hunt and play polo." This sounded all right. So that's how I went to Wellington and then the Royal Military Academy in Woolwich and was commissioned into the gunners in 1935.
I think you went out to India in 1937.
Yes, I was joining the 6th Medium Regiment because they were going out in 1937. And I was terribly anxious to get out to India. So we went out, and most of the regiment was in Mathura, and there was a single battery station in Agra, where, in fact, I was. And we spent a very, very happy 2 years out there. The soldiering itself was fascinating. One had a tremendous responsibility as a young officer. And the sporting side, of course, was terrific, with pig sticking and polo, shooting, everything you name it, it was all there. And the relationship between the British and Indian ranks was absolutely wonderful.
How did the approach of war affect you?
I don't believe in early 1939 we regarded it as a serious possibility at all, as far as I can remember. I went back on leave to England in summer of 1939, coming back in August 39, and we still didn't really expect war, as far as I can remember then. And I was posted as assistant adjutant to Mathura. And then war was declared. And there we were, as a regiment, sitting in Mathura. We thought of all those lucky chaps in Europe and in England who would be in it, and that we would be just left out there to rot. However, my departure to war was quite amusing. I think it was the day after war was declared when my colonel, who was a little bit deaf, went to the telephone and was told that Miles Wood, it's the name of our adjutant, was to go to Nowshera the next morning to join the 1st Field Regiment to go overseas. And so there he was, the lucky chap, and I was told to take over as adjutant, and my first duty was to arrange a party for the departure of our only officer going to war. And I remember so well, about midnight, the old Chuprassi, we called him, the Indian orderly, came up on his bicycle and said, "Telegram, Saab, telegram, Saab," and handed me a telegram, which I read. And this was nothing to do about Miles Wood at all. It was Wilde who would go to Nowshera the next morning. By that time, we were all fairly well healed, so the entire garrison came to my bungalow to help me pack for war, and it was quite hilarious. No one knew what to take to war. I mean, for example, hog spears. I decided definitely hog spears. A mashie niblick, yes, might be useful in the trenches, perhaps. Golf clubs, mess kit, no. And so it went on until my bearer, Mohammed, suddenly appeared out of the blue at about 3 o'clock in the morning and said, Saab going to war? And I said, yes, Saab goes to war. So, Mohammed, we say goodbye. And he said, no, if Saab goes to war, I go to war. And I said, well, that's wonderful. Who looks after your family? He said, well, Allah will provide. And I said, well, as long as it isn't me, that's fine. So you go back and alert your family and we'll meet on the station at 7 o'clock in the morning and off we go. So armed with my hog spears and Mesh and Iblik and Mohammed, the whole garrison saw me off to war and I joined the 1st Field Regiment at Nowshera. Now there they still had horses and they were under orders to go to Europe any day. Eventually, we were told to leave our horses behind, take our saddlery and our guns, and we went down by train to Karachi and embarked in troop ships across the Indian Ocean, and away we went. And when we got to Suez, we were told, instead of going to Europe, you get out here, and by the way, you're mechanized. And we saw on the jetty a collection of Morris Cullies, baby Austins, and things like that. And it's interesting, looking back on it, that of course at that time no British other rank could drive, and let alone the Indian troops. And so the officers hitched up the guns with literally bits of string, if I remember, to the back of these baby Austins, and we started ferrying the guns and the equipment to Cairo. We went down to Mina House, that well-known hotel, and we started driving off into the sand, and as soon as we got into the sand, down went our metal-wheeled guns into the sand, and there we sat. And it took us days to dig ourselves out.
Were the baby Austins and Morris Cowleys you took over civilian vehicles?
Yes, just ordinary, perfectly ordinary civilian vehicles, unmodified in any way.
Had they been painted in army colours?
No, just ordinary civilian stuff.
Do you remember what sort of guns you had with you?
I'm trying to remember. I think in India we had 18-pounders with metal-rimmed wheels, and I think that these became converted as soon as we arrived in the desert to what they call the 18/25-pounder. And then later we got the proper 25-pounders with the pneumatic tires.
Could you explain what your appointment was and what your duties were with the 1st Field Regiment?
Yes, well, when we actually set sail from Karachi, I was just an ordinary battery officer. But on board, we were told to reorganize onto a 3-battery, 2-troop basis. And I was appointed as a troop commander. So it was in that capacity, commanding a troop of 4 guns, that I arrived in Egypt. Shortly after that, I was made adjutant of the 1st Field Regiment. And then as the 4th Indian Division gradually assembled and formed in the deserts round Cairo and round Mina House, so I was promoted to be staff captain of the newly constituted headquarters, Royal Artillery, of the headquarters of the 4th Indian Division.
How was the divisional headquarters organised, and what was the place of the Royal Artillery headquarters within it?
Well, the divisional headquarters is commanded, of course, by a Major General, who is his Lieutenant Colonel, Grade 1, officer, and a G2 and a G3, and his administrative staff. The headquarters, Royal Artillery, is rarely the same as a brigade headquarters. It is completely independent little headquarters, commanded by a brigadier with a brigade major, a staff captain, an intelligence officer, and a signals officer, but they live with and form an integral part of the headquarters of the division, and yet are a completely autonomous sort of brigade headquarters commanding all the regiments in the division, that is to say the gunner regiments. And at that time, by the time the war really started in the desert, we had three field regiments, the 1st, 25th and 31st field regiments.
What was the strength and organisation of these artillery regiments?
Well, by the time we'd reorganised at that time, it was each regiment had a headquarters and three batteries, each of two troops, each troop having four guns. So that gave us 24 field guns in each regiment. Three regiments, they had 72 guns. Now, later, the integral divisional artillery organization included an anti-tank regiment and a light anti-aircraft regiment, but not in those early days.
How was the administration of the division arranged?
Well, there were, of course, the ordinary administrative units gradually coming in as the division formed. It took some time to form and come over from India. And it was interesting that when we left India, we had the most enormous administrative tale of hangers-on, if you like. For example, every officer had his bearer, sweepers, cooks, you name it. There was an enormous tale. And we had these until we formed as a division and did a bit of training, and we went up to Mersematru, which was our first really operational station. And still no fighting had taken place by then, or, of course, any bombing. We hadn't got any aircraft, and we certainly weren't worried by the Italians at that time. And I remember so well, breakfast time on a Sunday morning in Mersematru, there was suddenly crump, 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 and we said to ourselves, sappers working on Sunday morning, this is most extraordinary. When in rushed my bearer Mohammed, carrying my tin hat, pointing up at some little silver things in the sky, which turned out to be some Savoia Italian bombers, and crump, crump, crump went their bombs right the way through the camp, luckily, in fact, doing very little damage. And we suddenly realized that war was here. Things like slit trenches, which we'd never heard of before. So we dug like moles, and it was utterly predictable. The Italians bombed us at breakfast, lunch, tea, and supper, regularly every day at the same times. But one of the Indian tail, if you like to put it that way, was killed, and this suddenly brought to the head the problems of what was the position about Indian bearers and so on and so on. And the edict came through from India that overnight the whole tail was to be shipped back to India. And so overnight we lost our bearers, our cooks, our hangers-on, and our administrative tail, if you like. And there we were, left with fighting troops, and none of us had the faintest idea how to cook or look after ourselves in any way.
You mentioned that it took some time to form the division up. Can you remember how long it did take to get it functioning as a division?
It's a little bit difficult to be precise. I personally arrived in September 39 in the desert. And, of course, the 1st Field Regiment that I was with arrived then. My memory is that probably the division came over in a series of convoys, and that as the battalions and the regiments arrived, so they were formed into brigades, and gradually the whole structure of the division formed in our training ground near Cairo. And then, as we formed into proper brigades and divisional organization and administrative units and sappers and everything else, then our first move, as I mentioned earlier, was up to Merzimatru, where we really started operating and defending at that time as a fighting formation.
What were your duties as staff captain on the Royal Artillery headquarters?
Well, the headquarters Royal Artillery consisted of the CRA, the Commander Royal Artillery, who at that time was called Brigadier Ray Merlies. He was a very colourful character, who I believe in peacetime won all the golf tournaments in Latuke by the expedient of prepositioning half a bottle of champagne on the 10th tee, much to the dismay of his opponents. Now, his senior operational staff officer was the brigade major, who in those days was Major George Baker, who was not only an extremely efficient officer, but a much beloved one, and he was destined to become a master gunner and a field marshal. Then there was the staff captain, which I was, and I was responsible for all the administration of all the regiments in the divisional artillery. Then we had an intelligence officer and a signals officer, and that was, at that time anyway, that was the size of our staff.
Did you have any other ranks as clerks and orderlies attached?
Yes, we had certainly a chief clerk, probably another one, and yes, a few orderlies and things like that to make the thing tick administratively. We had our own little officers' mess, which was affiliated to but separate from the divisional headquarter one, and we were a separate entity but lived cheek by jowl with the rest of the headquarters of the division.
Was there normally a long working day?
Well, yes, I mean, there were no sort of set working hours as one understands work today. It was just going on really the whole time. And when fighting started, of course, it never stopped at all.
Then you'd have to deal with problems as they arose.
Absolutely.
Was the work of HQRA primarily administrative or operational?
Oh, entirely. Well, not entirely, but mostly operational. Because the brigadier commanded his regiments, and they were deployed as were thought fit at the time in question. In the early days, for a great deal of the time, one field regiment was affiliated to and in support of an infantry brigade and worked intimately with that brigade. And in the early days, that was roughly how it worked. Later in the war, of course, it became quite different when all the guns were grouped on many occasions for operational shoots operating as one unit. And in those cases, the control was entirely done by Headquarters Royal Artillery, who directed, indeed, the fire of the whole divisional artillery.
Presumably that must have meant having exceptionally reliable signals.
It meant having a very complicated set of wireless communications. And in the early days, our wireless sets were extremely unreliable, getting slightly better, but not a lot, towards the end of the war. But we were, of course, entirely dependent on very good communications.
Did you have any field telephone?
We had telephones, indeed, within the regiments, the observation posts, normally they'd line back to their guns from the batteries to regimental headquarters and then from regimental headquarters to Headquarters Royal Artillery. But that, of course, was in a more static type of war, And in the early days, where we are now, it was a very mobile type of war, and there wasn't really very often time for that.
What sort of techniques would you use to control a really massive concentration of artillery?
Well, it was evolved. There was no technique laid down at the start of the war because it hadn't ever happened. And I think, although I dare say it, I think the 4th Indian Division really pioneered the use of massive artillery fire in the Second World War. And basically the brigade major was on a network to his adjutants, and the adjutants to the observation posts, and of course the guns. And down from the front, from the OPE, in daylight anyway, news came through of an attack coming in or massing, and they used to call for either a regimental target, which was the fire of the whole regiment, or what they call, we used to call a mic target, which was the whole divisional artillery. And that was controlled by the brigade major, who used to control it through his adjutants. But if I could digress a little bit, perhaps to the end of the war in the desert, to give you some idea of what it ended up as. I was a brigade major for the 4th Indian Division, and just before the final, or during the final break into Tunis, when my division was doing the punch, we managed to get all the guns, and I mean all, under command of HQRA 4th Indian Division. As a brigade major, I dug a hole right in the FDLs with my wireless set, and the brigadier, of course, was there, and we sent off the second in command of every regiment in an armoured vehicle to go with the leading troops, and every time that the enemy held up the attack, one of these chaps used to come back to me saying, shall we say, 688 millimetres holding up the advance at map reference 123456. I was then able, through my communication set work at that time, to bring down the fire of, I think it was 350 guns, we say 5-10 rounds gunfire. It's a lot of shells, and we had no problems.
How long would it take to actually set up such a barrage?
It wasn't a barrage. A barrage is a creeping thing, and those are rather out, really, certainly under desert conditions. It was more concentrations at a given map reference, what I'm talking about there. And we had a thing called a time over target, because every weapon, whether it was a heavy gun or field gun or medium gun, the time of flight was slightly different. And so I used to say time over target, bang, and we used to do it in something like 2 minutes.
And would there then be 2 minutes of firing?
Yes, something like that, depending on what it was. And then you would lift the fire somewhere else to where it was required. And you could flick the fire of all these guns wherever you wanted. It was absolutely fantastic.
After Mesmer True, when did you first get involved in the fighting?
Well, the commander-in-chief then was Earl Wavell, who we all absolutely worshipped. And he had his, what has since become known as his famous first 40,000 troops. And we knew that the Italians were dug in great strength further out in the desert round Sidi Barani. And with the utmost secrecy, all the troops were just told it was an exercise. And it was planned that there would be an approach march of, I think it was 2 or 3 days, mostly by night, to lay on attacks against these series of Italian camps. There were three of them, Sidi Barani, Nabaiwa, I forget the other one. But this was an approach march completely in the open, where the Italian air could have spotted us at any time, but somehow we made it. And over a period of about 2 or 3 days, we attacked these Italian camps and captured them with a most enormous amount of prisoners. And really, we felt then the tails were right up, and we felt that we could push on and capture the whole of Cyrenaica with no problem at all. And then it was to our horror and surprise that as a division we were pulled out of the line. And we were told we were going down to the Sudan for a campaign in Eritrea. And I remember it was New Year's Eve, and we piled into a train and ended up in Suez. And there we found waiting for us a liner called the Reina del Pacifico in all its peacetime glory. I was fairly tired, and we hadn't had much sleep for several days, and filthy. And I was greeted in my cabin by a steward who had one look at me and said, "And at what temperature does Sir like his bath?" So that was tremendous. And followed by a sumptuous cold collation, as they called it, washed down by the South African liqueur Van der Ham, we went to bed in great comfort. The next day, sailing was postponed for 24 hours. Shore leave was offered. Nobody wanted to go ashore. And I can't tell you how wonderful it was to relax in such luxury after the desert.
What was your journey down to the Sudan like?
Absolutely blissful. We spent a few days going down in this lovely ship until we got to Port Sudan. And I was horrified to hear that the poor old Reina del Pacifico got sunk later in the war. But anyway, we got out, and there was a road party bringing up the MT, and some of us went up by rail. I was amongst those who went up by rail. And I think it was a day and a night or something like that, if I remember. And then we just got to, there was no station, there was nothing, just a bit of track. I think it was a place called Dera Deb, if I remember. But we just got out by the side of the track and dumped there and left until such time as the MT caught up with us.
How long did it take to come up to you?
If I remember, 2 or 3 days, something like that. It may have been a little bit more.
What were your first impressions of the Sudan?